It's now time for the Fantasy 411 Podcast.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Fantasy 411 Podcast. I'm Matthew Leach, talking fantasy baseball with MLB.com's lead fantasy writer, Fred Zinke. And, Fred, we're going to talk developments. We are going to talk relief pitchers, but you've got a big event coming up soon. So I'll give people a little preview before we'll talk about that in more depth later. But one of the big fantasy drafts of the year is coming up.
Yeah, the Tout Wars drafts are this weekend. I'll be participating in the mixed auction on Saturday at 3 p.m. But, yeah, there'll be AL drafts, NL drafts, I think a head-to-head league this year. So a lot of fun around New York, and, you know, people can follow online or listen on Sirius. It's going to be fun.
Outstanding. So we will definitely do a little preview of that. But as we do at this time, we're going to start with the news. And some bad news in Mets land. Asdrubal Cabrera told not even to do any activity for 2 weeks. I think some people may have initially heard that as out for 2 weeks, but to me that sounds like out of baseball for more than 2 weeks. Like he hard to see him playing opening day in my eye. So for you, first of all, what does that do for Cabrera's value? Because as a shortstop, he was, you know, not a star guy, but in a thin position, kind of an interesting player.
Yeah, for sure. He was, as you said, not a star guy and not a guy with a lot of upside, but he's kind of solid. You know, he'll get you the double-digit home run total, a few steals. You know, now I think it pushes him to the later rounds. Maybe you draft him as your last starting hitter and knowing he'll probably open the year on the disabled list, or maybe you just kind of draft him for a bench or DL spot and see where things go from there. It could create a nice buying opportunity where you can get him on your bench and then hopefully have a useful player later.
There's a couple related developments, or oddly related developments, actually, because the other news with the Mets this week is that they have apparently waived Ruben Tejada with ultimately the purpose of releasing him. That seems like a very odd fit at the time when their starting shortstop goes down, and that would seem to indicate something about Wilmer Flores. These two things in concert, how much more do you like Flores than a week ago?
I mean, yeah, it definitely indicates that they feel pretty confident in Flores. And, you know, I mean, ever since they brought in Cabrera in the offseason, I felt like they were pretty adamant that Flores would still be moved around the infield a lot and have a semi-regular role. Now, that being said, you can't be active in a mixed league pretty much for anyone unless you have a full-time role. So, to me, Flores is that perfect handcuff, really, to Cabrera. For example, someone could wait throughout a mixed league draft and late in the draft pick up both players, use Flores for 2 weeks, a month, whatever they need him for, and then as soon as Cabrera comes back, then I think you ship Flores to waivers.
You like Matt Reynolds at all? He didn't hit a lot last year, which is kind of disappointing. He was a guy that was pretty highly regarded in the past, not as any kind of immediate, but as a long-term or as a flyer or just as a prospect later in the year?
Yeah, no, not a lot of interest for me.
All right. Moving down our list, Johnny Peralta is going to be out a long time. That is definitely disappointing. It's disappointing for the Cardinals, and it is disappointing from a fantasy perspective. Are you even interested in stashing Peralta on your bench?
In NL only, yes. In mixed leagues, I would say probably not. And even if you have, I would say the only way I'm interested in Peralta is if I'm in a mixed league with unlimited DL slots. And there are some of those out there. I play in some, so if you have unlimited DL spots, then sure, if you want to take him in the last round, especially if you don't like the shortstop that you drafted that much, then that's fine. But if your league has a limit on DL slots, two or three, something like that, I probably can find better use for them than him, either players who will be back sooner or have the potential to make a bigger impact by the summer.
How much do you downgrade guys who are going to be out for a long period of time beyond just the time missed? By that, I mean, how much do you adjust what you expect for them when they come back for a guy who's going to miss that long as opposed to a guy who's going to miss a few weeks?
Yeah, that's definitely a concern. You know, can he hit the ground running when he comes back and you know, be, if he plays half a year, can he give us, you know, 50% of what we were expecting him to give us across a full year? I'll probably, maybe let's say he's going to play half the year, instead of him expecting him to give us 50% of what he was going to give us, I'll maybe expect 45. I mean, you have to play it safe a little bit there. You can think about it this way. When Peralta comes back, knowing what his upside is he someone you're going to feel like you have to get right back into your lineup right away? And to me, the answer is probably not. Like, I'll probably want to see him come back and play the first week or two and hit, and then I'll say, okay, sure, I'll put him in my lineup if I have a spot for him. If we're talking about a star player when he comes back off the disabled list, I'm going to say, okay, well, right away we need to put him in his lineup because even 80% or 90% of that star player is still better than my replacement player. But for Peralta, that's not really the case.
It probably will depend at least somewhat on what you have there, because I suspect for some people in some leagues, even 80% of Johnny Peralta will be better than what they were starting at that position.
Yeah, quite possibly. Also, because he'll come back so late into the season, you'll be pretty far into your standings in a roto league by then. So, and he's a power-only player. Like, he's not going to give you any speed. So for certain teams, Peralta will be a welcome addition, whether it's in June or July, you know, because you'll be looking for a few more homers. For some teams, you know, he might not fit the mix at all. And but you could stash him for half a year, and then by the time he comes back, you think, oh, well, I don't really need a power-hitting shortstop at this point. In my standings, I need a speedy shortstop, and then you're not as excited to get him back, and then his trade value won't be really high at that point.
A guy I recall you like quite a bit, Matt Wieters, expressed some relief yesterday. There was some worry. It was the elbow that he had surgery on was sore. They got the MRI. They said, look, this doesn't look that bad. He was relieved. But he still got to wait at least until the pain's gone. So Wieters is out for at least a little while. I am a little torn because on the one hand, look, it's good that it's not a recurrence of the ligament injury or anything like that, but he was slower to get back to where they expected than they hoped last year. It did not go as cleanly, I think, as everybody had hoped and expected for Wieters getting back to where he was last year. I'm beginning to worry that you may just need to bake in a little more missed time from Wieters than you would like. Are you getting there? Do you dock him at all? Is he a health worry for you?
Yeah, I mean, he has to be. And as you said, I was really optimistic on him, and I want to stay optimistic on him. But, you know, you have to build in a little lighter load now, especially because they signed a DH. So with Pedro Alvarez there now, they don't have the flexibility of putting him at DH for stretches of time. So, I mean, if I was hoping for 500 at-bats, and, you know, he's done that before, I think now you have to downgrade that to 450, maybe even 425, something like that. And that obviously takes off counting stats across the board. I think that I'm not going to totally shy away from Wieters yet in mixed leagues. I mean, he's going to drop in drafts. That makes him maybe more interesting to me in some ways. And Caleb Joseph showed last year that he had a little bit of pop. You know, in his career, he has 20 homers and 566 at-bats. So, you know, for a last-round catcher, that's not so bad. So someone could, say, take Wieters if he really falls in their draft and then pick up Joseph in the last round. And then if Wieters were to start the season on the disabled list, you have a replacement for a couple of weeks, similar to what we were just talking about with Cabrera and Flores.
Has Wieters reached that point for you where even beyond this year, maybe you just kind of view him with a little bit of a skeptical eye health-wise just going forward, that maybe he's a guy, even if he's not injury-prone, that maybe he's a guy who is not a quick recoverer, just somebody who, because some people's bodies just don't do that.
Yeah, to me, this is the make-or-break year for him. Like, he's had the 2 years with injury troubles. Hasn't totally fallen off the plate, but the 2 years with injury troubles, if he doesn't play, you know, 115 or 110 or something games this season, then I think it's time to just build in a decent amount of DL time or rest time for him going forward. So for keeper league owners, like, this might be even a bigger deal than for those of us in one-year leagues.
There was a cry around the baseball blogosphere, baseball Twitter sphere this week as Corey Seager came down with what we hope, what we believe, what appears to be a minor issue. How worried are you about Corey Seager?
I'm going to say I'm not that worried. This, to me, may be – the Dodgers have said they're optimistic he'll be ready for opening day. We've had him grouped with Xander Bogaerts and Francisco Lindor, you know, in that second tier of shortstops. Maybe this is the tiebreaker that puts him at the back of that tier. Do you feel that way? Like, if you were drafting – you know, in an hour, would you rather take Bogaerts and Lindor now just because they don't have a knee sprain?
I don't know. I'm still a little skeptical on Lindor. I just want to see him do it again. He was really good, but I have a little bit of skepticism about the bat in the short term that I don't have about Seager. So maybe it makes it more of a push, the whatever injury risk there is with Seager or health risk there is versus the bat. But I like Seager's bat more than I like Lindor, so I probably still like the player more, even with a little bit of a worry. Bogaerts, I feel, is the highest. I don't know if he's the highest floor. I think he's got a real narrow range. I don't have a lot of variation in my expectations on Bogaerts. I'd like to see him burst forth with a power spike this year. It wouldn't shock me if he did, but I'm also not counting on it. And if he doesn't, I think we have a real good idea of the kind of player he is.
Yeah, no, I totally agree on that. For me with Seager, yeah, I'm not going to panic on it. You know, we didn't move him in our MLB.com, you know, player preview rankings, and we have a cheat sheet now that people can access, you know, on our fantasy page. And we haven't moved Seager at all, you know, based on the knee sprain. So that kind of says that, I agree with you that I don't think it's a big concern yet. It did come back to something we talked about last week, where we talked about if one position had multiple injuries during spring training, when we started to change our view on that position. And for about 5 minutes, I wondered, okay, we've lost Peralta, we've lost Cabrera, now we just lost Seager. Is it time to reevaluate the shortstop position? But as it turns out, we haven't lost Seager, and Peralta and Cabrera aren't really game changers at that position. So I'm not changing it yet, but we were close to maybe reevaluating that position for draft day.
All right. The Angels rotation, they're having problems. Jared Weaver is throwing 79 and is probably going to start the season on the DL. C.J. Wilson probably going to start the season on the DL. Either of these guys hold any value to you at all, or are they sort of off the radar right now?
Yeah, they're off the radar for me. They both have one big flaw in their game when they're healthy, and that Weaver doesn't strike out batters anymore, and Wilson can't get his whip down. So, I mean, that limits really the potential for either one. And now you throw in the injuries, and to me, in a mixed league, I wouldn't even have them on the draft list. In an AL-only league, you know, last-round pick and put them straight into your DL slot, like, I guess if you want to, but I might not even go there.
I have a little hope. It would not surprise me to see Wilson have a run where he was a guy you'd be interested in having. I just don't see. I don't see how Weaver gets it back. I don't see Weaver throwing 85, and the next right-hander throwing 82 miles an hour who has fantasy value, who doesn't throw a knuckleball, will be the first one I can remember.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think, I applaud Weaver. I've seen some of the quotes from him in recent days, and super competitive about this and can't wait. You know, he's pushing to get back out there and believes he can do it. And, you know, I hope he can do it. It's admirable that he believes he can, and even with that velocity. But there's just no upside there. I mean, you're better off stashing, you know, some teams, you know, starter in waiting, the next guy to go in a rotation who has a lot of upside, or an eighth inning guy who might get to be a closer at some point. Those guys have more potential than Weaver does.
Aside from Garrett Richards, is there anybody in that Angels rotation that you like?
I don't mind Andrew Heaney. Like, I think he's fine at the back end, I think he's a spot starter in regular mixed leagues. Maybe in deep mixed leagues, he's an every week guy. Matt Shoemaker, I used to like. I haven't totally shaken that love yet. Maybe you can talk me out of it right now. I know he gives up a lot of homers, but he keeps his whip down. So for me, I'm always just right on the fence with that type of pitcher where if they keep the ball in the yard, they're pretty effective, but they just don't do it enough. Do you think I should just end that? I know he's not having a great spring.
Yeah, I'm just sort of consistently skeptical on him. I am skeptical on guys who break in at 27. I am skeptical of guys who didn't really light up the minors. He could have there could be great matchups where I could see streaming him, but he does nothing for me at all. I just, even the strikeout rate he's had, I'm skeptical that he does it again.
Yeah, no, I totally understand that. As I said, I will sometimes be a sucker for all those low whip, high homer guys, Josh Tomlin, Marco Estrada, Chris Young, all those guys, because when they're going well, you know, they can be quite valuable. If the ball's not leaving the yard, like, they give you great ratios, but it just always seems to run out at some point.
Yeah, I just feel like the risk-reward on those guys always chases me away.
Yeah.
some distressing news for the Astros. Just today we learned, just within the last few hours, we learned that it sounds like Lance McCullers will start the season on the DL. He's a guy that personally I never fully bought into as a starter. He's one of those guys that, honestly, he could have a really good year as a starter, and I'd still, a year from now, be like, is this guy really a starter long-term? So I admit I come into this with general skepticism on him, but you got a guy, first of all, young pitcher with a shoulder issue, even if it's minor, is very worrisome to me. What do you do with McCullers on draft day?
Yeah, he goes right down, I think, to the late rounds now. The initial comments I read, in the initial articles after it was announced he would open the year on the DL, weren't really optimistic. Like, they weren't, like, timeline-related where they said, he's gonna take 3 days to rest and he's going to start picking up a baseball again, and this is his timeline, and this is when he'll be back in the rotation. There really wasn't anything definitive. And, the upside's definitely there. Like, we saw that last year. But we just don't really know when he's going to be back. And the Astros have five viable starter options without him around, so they're not going to push him back. So, to me, he goes down to that, high upside, late-round pick with the understanding that you just may not get much out of him this year. We just don't really know right now.
I would say I chose to read some of what I've seen from them is actually kind of encouraging in a way, not so much in the short term but in the long term, because it kind of sounded to me like what they were saying was, look, we don't want this kid to do anything dumb. So rather than saying a week or 2 weeks or a month or whatever it is and having him rush to make it, we are saying we want you healthy. We don't want you to do anything that's going to jeopardize your career in the long run in order to be there opening day or April 15th or some arbitrary day. So get well, get healthy, and if that is 2 weeks, that's great. If it's a month, okay. But I kind of liked, and this is maybe my sort of bias of not really liking the sort of macho deal with it, get out there, I don't care if you're hurt culture that sometimes happens in baseball, but I kind of liked the way they approached it, only in that in the long run it sounds like they're not going to push McCullers to do anything that harms him long-term. So I hear what you're saying, that they're not putting a specific time on it, but I think that's partly because it's a young guy and they don't want him to rush and ruin his whole year.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And, from the moment that they added Doug Fister, they had six starters for five spots, and that was a really dicey, competition there between probably Mike Fiers and Scott Feldman for the last rotation spot. And at the same time, the Astros had talked about limiting his innings this season. So the optimistic point of view would say that they just, saw him being slow getting going this year, said, we want to limit his innings anyways. Let's just open the year with the five veterans in the rotation, in a positive way. Like, if you're looking at it positively, he'll come back, by May or something like that. Now they won't have to worry about his innings at all this year. I think that's your best case scenario. And then the Astros can figure out what to do with having six starters for five spots in May, because by then, someone else may be injured or ineffective or something like that. But there was no real easy answer about whether it was Fiers or Feldman who should go to the bullpen.
Yeah, and that's the one thing that this does for me from a fantasy perspective is I like Fiers. He's a pretty nice pitcher. He's not a guy I'm going to rush to get, but Fiers having what would appear to be a secure rotation spot at the start of the year, I realize he's now in the DH league. He's not in Milwaukee anymore, but he seems like a guy who I'm kind of going to have an eye on now.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I like Fiers a lot. I think he's now worth putting in your opening week rotation in like 10-team and 12-team leagues for sure. It's interesting when they added Fister and then they were talking about having this dilemma for the fifth starter spot, I thought, oh, it's obviously Feldman who shouldn't be in the rotation. And then I realized that was kind of me looking at it from a very fantasy-centric point of view, because Feldman's not a mixed-league starter because his strikeout rate's really low, his whip's fairly high. And then I went back and actually looked at what Feldman's done for the Astros, and I kind of thought about it some more, and I thought, no, I can see why the Astros would like Feldman in the rotation. From an ERA perspective, from a logging innings perspective, he's a useful major league starter, but he's not a great fantasy starter. Fiers is, because his ratios are solid and his strikeout rate's pretty high.
Our last news item before we get on with the other stuff, Edwin Encarnacion dealing with what was called yesterday an oblique issue. I don't think I saw anybody use the word injury, but obliques are one of those things that make me nervous. You come back too quickly, you aggravate it, and you miss even more time. I don't entirely know what to make of it, but I know that if it were a sore ankle and they said a week, I wouldn't think twice. But when it's an oblique and they say, well, a week or whatever it is, it makes me more nervous. So does that particular injury or Encarnacion's age or anything about that put you off him a little bit?
Maybe a little bit. He has had nagging injuries just in the last couple of years. Like, he doesn't miss massive amounts of time, but there's often just these little things, you know, irking him, throughout the season. So, to me, maybe this is a tiebreaker thing, like I was talking about with Seager, where, you know, Encarnacion's right in that tier of first baseman with Chris Davis, Jose Abreu. You know, now on draft day, if you were thinking about taking him at the top of that group, maybe you take him at the end of the group. I mean, he's still in a great situation. One thing I've noticed with him in the last couple of years, he tends to have these amazing stretches. Like, he'll have like a 1 month stretch every year where he just goes bananas and everything clicks and his timing looks perfect. And then he has stretches during the year where his timing's just off and he's not getting a hold of everything. He's going to basically not play in spring training this year. Like, he had an issue with a tooth and he's barely played in spring training to this point. And now, you know, we're looking at a week, maybe 2 weeks, you know, basically close to the end of spring training before he's back into game action. So I wouldn't be surprised to see his timing off early in the season, just because that seems to be kind of how he rolls, and him to get off to a bit of a slow start.
And so we are now done with the news. Let's move on and talk a little Tout Wars. It's a very big deal in the fantasy world. How do you prepare for something like this, where you know it's experts, you know people really put a lot of time and a lot of thought into this? I mean, I realize you do fantasy. That's what you do. So you put a lot of thought and a lot of time into all your drafts. But when you approach something like this, how do you approach it?
Yeah, I would say if your league's hard, and this league's going to be very hard, then I try to always remind myself, like, I'll say, don't get cute. Like, I'll try to remind myself of that during the auction and before the auction, in the sense of, you know, if you're drafting in a league that you think's not too difficult and some of the other owners, you know, don't have a great depth of knowledge, you might say, oh, I can leave that guy for a couple more rounds, or I think I can nab this guy for a dollar or two in an auction and no one else is really on to him. But when you go into one of the expert leagues, or if you're in a high-stakes league, or just with a group that you know is really competitive, you have to really not get cute. And if you want someone, you have to accept that you're probably going to have to pay the reasonable price for them.
I want to talk a little about auctions, because, you know, I remember, goodness, I don't even know how many years ago, probably 25 years ago, reading the, you know, the original Rotisserie League baseball books, and those that was auction. They talked about the player profiles had dollar values next to them. As fantasy baseball became bigger, became more accessible to everybody, became drafts. I think now in recent years, auctions are becoming, I think more people are getting involved in auctions because online tools now use them, and so you can do it online and you can not really have to do all the math yourself. So I suspect that in any given year there are quite a few people who are auction drafting for the first time. It's a very big question and probably a difficult one to answer, but are there general tips for people new to auction drafts that they might need to think of that they might not automatically think of as they go into these?
I enjoy auctions because of the creativity of them. Like, I really like how you can structure your team however you want. If you don't want anyone who would have gone in the first three rounds of a draft, you don't have to do that. And, you know, you can get a lot of players from the next, say, 10 rounds, or you can get a lot of stars and then have to pay the price later and get a lot of late-round type players. I love the creativity of them. That being said, you know, if someone's getting into auctions and they haven't really done them before, they have to recognize they are very tiring and very stressful throughout. Like, you have to be engaged the entire time, and you have to be well prepared for it. It's not like I mentioned our cheat sheet already. Like, if you're going into a draft, it's easy to just print the cheat sheet, and then when it's your pick, take the guy the highest dollar value left beside him and then relax in between picks and cross the guys off. You get into an auction, and, you know, you have to be in on every player. You have to be constantly adjusting based on who's off the board and how much they went for, those kinds of things. I think the best thing that someone can do is try, whether they print off a cheat sheet like ours or whether they create their own, but try to get into that auction with a dollar value assigned to every player and then adjust from there. I think if you don't have that, then the task is just too daunting. You have to have some sort of starting point as to what you think players are worth, and then maybe an idea of which players you're targeting.
So we we now move on to talk relief pitchers, and this is a weird position to address because you're sort of going for two different things. There's a lot, maybe more than any other place, opportunity is really critical. There are guys who you just wouldn't even think about that if they get a particular role, suddenly they're on your radar. So we're going to talk about philosophy of that in a little bit, but first of all, your tier one is Wade Davis, Kenley Jansen, Craig Kimbrell, and that's it. I assume that under other circumstances, Chapman might be there, but he's not. So out of those guys, is there one that you have at the top of that list for this year?
Yeah, and first of all, you're right. In normal circumstances, Chapman would be there for sure. They're all so close. I kind of like Davis the best. I feel like I have the fewest questions about him. Kimbrell's terrific. He is switching leagues. And the AL East is a pretty powerful place. So, we're talking minor things when we're separating for the top closer. And sometimes I find that things just happen to Jansen. Like, he gets injuries sometimes, whereas Davis, pretty durable, pretty amazing. And then the Royals just are a save-generating machine. Like, over the last few years, they have generated over 50 save chances every year. Like, Greg Holland was always up near the save leaders. They have the same, formula this year, basically the same team they just won the World Series with. So I feel like he's the most likely of those three players to produce, 50 saves.
How much do you worry about Kimbrell's strikeout rate? It was still very good last year, but it's headed the wrong direction. He is not the same untouchable, otherworldly guy that he was 3-4 years ago. Even if it falls some, he's still very good. But how confident are you that he keeps it at that ludicrous 13 that he kind of needs to keep it at if he's only going to pitch 60 innings to be that real top-tier guy?
Yeah, and that's why I kind of have him third amongst that group. I wouldn't be surprised to see the strikeouts, especially him going to the AL, I wouldn't be surprised to see the strikeouts drop a little bit. I know he's not facing the pitcher, like a starter or something, but some of those AL lineups are pretty deep. And, we're just talking a few strikeouts. Like, he's kind of on that cusp now where a few less strikeouts and he kind of drops down to tier two. Would you be surprised to see him in the second tier by next year? Like, would that shock you if he dropped down there, or do you think he's Craig Kimbrell, he lives in the first tier for a few more years?
Wouldn't surprise me even a little bit. And again, one of the things I look at, and we don't know how the Red Sox are going to use him. It's possible that he'll get 70 innings, but one of the things that stands out about Kimbrell is that he's pitched 61 and 59 innings the past 2 years. And the Red Sox have a lot of good relievers in the back of the pen. They are not going to be using him for 4 or 5 outs. And in fact, they have guys that they could probably go to if Kimbrell's pitched 2 or 3 days in a row and they want to give him a break. They have alternatives to him. So I just, the innings combined with even the slight dip in the K rate, I would not be surprised at all. I'm not saying I'm down on him. He's obviously one of the best, but I'm going to let somebody else take him higher than I expect I would want to take him. I'm not staying away from him, and if there comes a point where I'd say, oh, man, Kimbrell's still on the board. But my guess is that in nearly any draft I'm doing, somebody's going to like him more than I do.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'll roll this into now our Tier 2. Do you see, and you can give everyone the names, but do you see a pitcher in our Tier 2 that you would rather have than Kimbrell, or do you think that Kimbrell's still ahead of all those pitchers?
The guy that seems the most likely to me to be that guy and maybe to replace Kimbrell in Tier 1 next year, if you're putting it that way, is Ken Giles. I know the walk rate is still a little high. I know he's also a guy whose strikeout rate took a slight dip last year, but I like him a lot. Even going to the DH league, I just think that's a guy whose upside is extremely high and a guy who could just turn into an utterly dominant guy this year.
Yeah, no, I could see that too. And when I initially started doing projections, I thought that I was going to project Giles for 100 strikeouts, and then seeing his strikeout rate drop last year, I ended up not putting him that high in that category, which is really a lot of the separation between Tier 1 and Tier 2, because the Tier 2 guys really have about the same chance as the Tier 1 guys of getting 40 saves, which is what you're really looking for when you invest in early round picks. So it's really the strikeouts, and I guess those ultra-low ratios, that whip around 1 flat or maybe even a little lower, And as you said with Giles, like that really wasn't that. That's not a lock. So, but you're right. I could see him taking another step up this year.
So the full list on tier two that you have right now for people who are interested, and I'm sure they are: David Robertson, Giles, Zach Britton, Familia, Cody Allen, Hector Rondon, Mark Melancon, Trevor Rosenthal, and Aroldis Chapman. The other guy from that group, Chapman, we've talked about, and he's a guy who, if he were playing, if you're on the roster 162 games, would be in Tier 1. The other guy that really intrigues me from that group is Familia, a guy who was very good last year and somebody who sort of started changing the way that he threw, added that sort of turbo sinker. He's another guy, and he's also, he threw 78 innings last year. I don't know if the Mets were going to lean on him again that hard this year. I don't know if the Mets want to lean on him again that hard this year, but he's gone 77 and 78. He's a guy that you'd have to think the Mets feel they're comfortable doing that, getting a little more out of, and they still, I don't think, have really addressed, they don't have the depth of guys in front of him that the Red Sox do. So Familia's the other guy in there that really catches my eye that I would sort of be targeting. But the thing I kind of wanted to ask you in regards to this group is you have some age split there, and you have some guys, some younger guys, Rosenthal, Giles, Familia. You have some guys who have been around for a while, Robertson, Melancon. And I'm always the older a reliever is, the more skeptical I am of him, especially in this age of pure power where velocity, almost without exception, doesn't come back. And most of these guys are losing a little velocity every year. Does that make sense to you? Do you sort of have any extra level of skepticism for guys in their 30s, not even late 30s, but guys who have been doing this for a few years about whether they can maintain?
I haven't worried about it too much in the past unless, as you said, unless they're really getting into their late 30s, just because they don't log the workload. Now, I know their job is to come in, you know, throw fire, get some guys out quick, and then get out of there. At the same time, they don't have to have that heavy workload, so they do get, you know, a little more time off, and they don't have to put as many innings on their arms. So I'm never worried about it too much, unless I see signs of it coming. Now, Melancon's an interesting one in that early last season, you know, Twitter was crying about how his velocity was down and strikeout rate was down, and he was going to lose his closer job basically any day, and he didn't. And he ended up getting, you know, roughly 50 saves last year. And he was terrific. And there was a time, say, around the end of April last season where you could have traded for Melancon at a discount in a lot of fantasy leagues because people were very worried about him because of velocity, and he made it all work for him. So now as I go into this year, I wonder, okay, so do we just not worry about that with Melancon, or did he just successfully walk the tightrope last year and we're just kind of waiting now for the other shoe to drop and for him to do what was expected of him last April and lose his job at some point? He would be an example to me. Would he be someone who worries you with a possible velocity drop?
Yeah, Melancon's a guy. It's not even that he hasn't been good, because obviously he's been very good. He's just one of those guys, I can't even explain why. Just in any given year, I don't really trust it. You know, part of that is a slight dip in the strikeout rate last year, though, again, he's been pretty consistent. I can't give you a reason why, but this is something we talk about sometimes. There are guys that you just... If this is the year Melancon blows up and I've got him, I'm going to feel really dumb as somebody who's sort of perpetually a little skeptical on him, and so I'm just going to probably find another way. Again, like I was talking about a few minutes ago, if there's a point where he falls and suddenly he's at a place where he's way below I expected, I'll take him. But I'm just kind of generally a little more bearish on him than some people are.
Yeah, no, I understand that. And, you know, this comes back to something we've talked about before where there's a big tier here of you know, second-tier closers. You probably want to get one of them. You're in a draft. Do you take the approach? You really have two choices. You can take the approach of saying, I'm going to wait till that tier thins out. And if I end up with Melancon or maybe someone else who I don't feel totally confident in, but, you know, he's the last one from that tier, then I'll take him. And I've seen Melancon, for example, go before Familia in some drafts. Or do you feel, you know, and this is every owner's individual decision, or do you feel like you need to get, there's a couple guys in that tier that you really believe in, and do you want to have them? And, you know, that is the beauty of an auction where you can just pay for the ones that you want and not touch the other ones. But in a draft, you really have to make that decision. Do you want to get on the front end of this tier two closer run and get your Familia, whether it's Cody Allen, whether it's Zach Britton, the guy that you like, or are you comfortable just waiting and leaving it up to chance. And, you know, as you mentioned, if you get one that you don't really believe in and then he loses his job by the end of April, you feel kind of dumb because you kind of say to yourself, oh, I saw that coming and I just let it happen.
Move on down for Tier 3. Is it quite a mix of guys. Jonathan Papelbon, Sean Tolleson, Francisco Rodriguez, Houston Street, Brad Boxberger. As is always the case when we get down to Tier 3, there are reasons not to like nearly any of those guys, but if I tell you that for me out of that bunch, Boxberger stands really well ahead of them, almost as a Tier 2.5, are you with me or are you not buying that?
Actually, I'm interested in your rationale because I haven't – Boxberger was really inconsistent last season, so what makes you put him at the front end of that group?
I really like the consistent – I like the strikeout rate. I think he's safe. I don't know who they turn to. McGee's gone. I don't know what their alternative is, and I think they're going to be using a lot of their guys for multiple innings. They're talking about this strategy of 4, 5, 6 outs from these guys. I wouldn't be surprised if it's a whole bunch of guys going 4, 5, 6 outs and one guy pitching the ninth, so I feel like he's pretty safe. You know, I think that's going to be a team that has a lot of 3-2 and 2-1 leads. I think the opportunity is very good. And I just like he's a power guy. He's a guy that I just sort of believe in the skills or maybe even more accurate with the tools. You know, a guy like Papelbon, a guy like Rodriguez, man, this could absolutely be the year that it just comes apart for either of those guys. I don't expect it will, but I don't see that from Boxberger. I see more upside potential than downside risk with him.
Yeah, no, that makes sense, and I like your theory of, you know, them being really, really tied to him. Like, they don't have a lot of great other alternatives, and when I look around in the rest of that tier, like, Houston Street's fairly injury-prone, and, like, eventually that's going to catch up with him in a more serious way. K-Rod's switching over to the American League, and the Tigers do have some other options now. He is homer-prone at times, so the Tigers do have some other options now. Tolleson, he was really good last year. I like Tolleson, but the Rangers have a lot of other options, too, if he doesn't get off to a good start. Papelbon's the other one in that tier to me where his team's really tied to him. When I look in the Nationals bullpen, I don't see anyone who could replace him unless it was really dire straits. So, I know people have their objections to Papelbon, you know, in the real world of baseball, but for fantasy, he generally delivers pretty solid ratios, and the Nats should have a winning record. And with Drew Storen gone, I just can't. He'd have to be pretty bad, wouldn't he, before they look at anyone else in the ninth inning?
I definitely think so, yeah. I think that's the way they want to do it. I don't think they have a whole lot of alternatives. He's just a guy, you know, as every year a little more the power goes away, and he's remained effective, but he's just one of those guys that I can't help wondering how much longer he can sort of stave off decline. And hey, maybe it's another year that it happens, but much like with Rodriguez, I put them both in the same boat in a lot of ways. Like, those are just two guys that I just wonder how much longer they can keep fighting it off and keep not giving in to declining velocity and not being as able to overpower guys anymore.
Yeah, no, it's a good point, and this comes into how you want to address the closer position in that you'll need two or three in every league. So, you know, do you want to invest in those? We're kind of at the point where you were investing in one of those guys as your second closer. So do you want to invest in one of those as your second closer and kind of take your chances? You know, you would target Boxberger, you know, like other people might target someone else, but in general, do you want to target one of those players, or do you want to pay the premium and get Jansen and Familia? I mean, you have to pay more to do that, but then you're not as worried about one of your closers losing their job, because this is, you know, as you alluded to at the beginning, the only position where you can go from having a lot of value to absolutely no value in the span of one news conference from a manager.
That's well put. So we are just about at the end. There's one last thing we need to talk about, which is the MLB.com fantasy baseball cheat sheet. A very cool tool. Tell people how they should use that.
Yeah, I mean, the cheat sheet can help you, whether you're in a draft or an auction. I mean, it has auction values on it, and as I mentioned earlier, that's a great way to go into your auction with values, and then you can play with the exact numbers as the auction goes along, where if you feel like your auction table is really bidding up stars or not bidding them up much and how you want to adjust. So it has that resource flows with auctions, but it's also so useful for drafts in the sense of, you know, it has a top 100 rankings on it, and it has a dollar value beside every player, and that value, you know, obviously correlates to where we think they should go on a draft. So you can just work your way right through it on draft day. I mean, people in position like I am will spend lots of time making their own spreadsheets and making their own lists for a draft, but we totally understand that not everybody has the time to do that, and this is a way where, you know, in just a minute, you can have that printed off, loaded up, printed off, take it into your draft room, and we're updating that, you know, virtually every day, every 2 days. So, I mean, you're not going to see, you know, outdated information, Johnny Peralta listed as your 10th shortstop or something like that. Like, that's not on there, so you don't have to worry when you get in your draft room that you're going to make a huge mistake from it.
One of my favorite things about the cheat sheet is that it's not just rankings and values. There are some other little categories. I got rookie picks from Jim Callis, some personal favorites from Jim Duquette, a buyer beware page. There's some of that kind of thing that I think, you know, a lot of times we're looking for that stuff, and sometimes you just kind of blank. Sometimes you say, man, who is that guy I liked, and you can't find him on a list or whatever. To have those sort of prompts is also a neat feature beyond the regular rankings.
No, you're right, and often I'll get, during the Twitter chat sessions we have, I'll often have general questions from owners saying, name a couple late-round rookies that I can stash on my bench, or name a couple guys who are injured at the start of the year, you know, who I should stash away, and they'll help me later on. And if you're in a draft, you don't have the time to go online and get those answers. So, you know, if you're in there with a cheat sheet like that, and, yeah, maybe some of those guys aren't in the rankings or aren't in that spot in the rankings, but you hit round 27 in your draft, and you think, oh, I think I'm due to stash a rookie, or I think I'm due to stash, I got DL space, I'm going to get an injured pitcher and get him back later. Oh, who are some of those guys? And, you know, as you said, there's those extra little lists on the bottom. You see Zach Wheeler or someone like that, and you pick him up, and it could – leagues are won and lost often on very small amounts of points. So those little things can make the whole difference in whether you win your league or not.
All right. Well, that's the Fantasy 411 podcast this week. I'm Matthew Leach. He's Fred Zinke. Thanks very much for your time. Thanks, everybody, for listening. For everybody, say we do this again in a week.
Yeah, already looking forward to it.